sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A wild week of market swings. Signs of a bubble starting to show through. And inflation starting to peak around the corner. Our guest today, Lou Bassanisi, Disruptive Tech Research. All this and much more on episode number 417 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey there, Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the second week of June 2015. We have a great guest on board with us today, and I have a few things I want to go through before we get to him and discuss some of the more important things that moved markets last week, some of the things that will be moving markets definitely next week. No question about it. We have Greece in the spotlight, China too. There are some real concerning factors when it comes to what is happening right now in the negotiations with Greece. It seems that Greece is continuing to stonewall using their game theory and not making any progress at all. As a matter of fact, there was some, just a little bit of movement on Friday afternoon, but that was shot down. There was a proposal that maybe about $400 million worth of excessive pension payments, quote-unquote excessive pension payments made to some of the individuals that were a little out of line would be cut, and possibly that would be made up from some of the military money and something else. And there was all sorts of little discussion, but it was shot down by the IMF. Bottom line, it was shot down. And that was just a little wrinkle, a little discussion that went awry, but everybody was excited just for moments about that. Still, the Greek markets were pretty much trashed on Friday with the fact that even though there was some hope at the mid part of the week that some kind of a resolution, or at least maybe not a resolution, but some kind of compromise would be made, was totally obliterated. The folks that were negotiating, some of them left early because they couldn't get anywhere. And once again, even though there has been a good amount of rumor, pretty much as I see it, has been originating from Greece. They are doing all they can to try to keep their markets alive. People holding their money or trying to keep people to hold their money inside the country, inside the banks. And they're doing a very poor job on the other end, which is to convince anyone at the ECB, the IMF, or anywhere else that they're willing to do anything. So right now, they're trying their best by the end of this weekend, before markets open, because they're scared crapless about markets, of course, that they want to get some kind of deal pounded out. Something at least that looks like there could be something in the near future, because I know that the clock is ticking for that IMF payment, which they bundled, which we talked about last week. So there is a lot riding on whatever they actually come to the table with this weekend. But so far as I'm seeing it, there's not much that has really been resolved at all between the two sides. And clearly both sides are doing their best to talk up that something would be done, but at the same time, really very far apart from any kind of resolution. Let's take a look at what happened last week and what we're going to see for next week. We did see that at the end of the week, the three major U.S. stock indices were a little changed from the week before. And over the course of the week, the S&P gained a total of about 0.06%, reached 2,094.11. The Dow rose about 0.28% to 17,898, and the NASDAQ lost about 0.3%, about a third of a percent to fall to 5,051. Now, crude prices rose. That was kind of a really interesting week on crude, to about 1.5% to close at about just under $60 at $59.96. And gold snapped a 3-week losing streak to gain 1%. Now, we did see that there was a good surprise on consumer sentiment. The University of Michigan reported that consumer sentiment, which was for May, ended at 90.7, which was a very poor reading. But the preliminary June index rose to 94.6. So that was good. So it's definitely up from May. We did see that there was definitely some inflationary signs. The producer price index came in pretty hot, one of the hottest we've seen in a while. A lot of that had to do with rising gasoline and egg prices, which was about 0.5% gain in the PPI, It was the largest amount since 2012. The core PPI, which takes out food and energy, rose only 0.1% following the April 0.2% retreat. So it definitely is on the rise. And we are seeing, if we include some food and energy in there, which you and I, by the way, we participate in, right? I mean, it's not something that we can just statistically strip out of everything because we do pay those prices. And those things were up. We also saw that there was a nice jump, actually, in retail sales for May. So it came in at 1.2. Estimates were about 1.1%. And that was good. Home improvements were pretty good. Gasoline sales, as you would imagine, with higher gas prices, ramped up pretty well, about 3.5%. General purchases increased 2.1% at home improvement outlets, 2% in auto dealers and auto parts stores, 1.5% at clothing shops, and about 1.5% at online retailers. So the April retail sales were revised from a flat 0.2%, just up slightly. So that's good. 3 months of straight gains. Now, next week, very quickly, what are we going to be looking for? Well, obviously, we have this whole issue with Greece, but let's talk about what is going to be moving the needle in terms of some things that are economic and earnings related. So on Monday, we're going to see industrial output. Kind of important, not earth-shattering, but somewhat important. Tuesday, the Census Bureau reports the housing starts, and then we start earnings into this section. We're going to have Adobe, Bob Evans, Lazy Boy. The Fed is going to be issuing a policy statement on Wednesday, looking to see if maybe there's a change in their commentary about when they're going to potentially do something with rates. We're going to see earnings from FedEx, Jabil Circuit, Oracle, and Pier 1. Then we're going to see the Consumer Price Index on Thursday, always follows a few days after PPI, and also the new initial claims, which have been sub 300,000 for some time, showing that the employment part of the economy and that engine is doing really well. The Conference Board's latest set of leading indicators are going to be on Thursday as well. And we're going to see earnings from Darden, Kroger, Rite Aid, Smith & Wesson, and Red Hat. Watch that Red Hat. We'll see what happens there because there's been a lot of movement in the whole security and internet space, and it could be some of these, we call them software-related, internet software-related companies, and they're all about Linux, may do something. CarMax and KB Homes are reporting on Friday. So that's kind of the roundup of what's going to be happening next week, aside from some of the things we've talked about with regard to Greece and probably some of the things that we have to talk about with China. I'll get to China after we talk with our guest because it's something I want to spend a little time on. Two things I want to mention before we get to Lou, and that is this. I thought it was really interesting that we have the screening process that we look at 5,000 different stocks or so and pare it down looking for, okay, well, who meets the criteria of things like earnings growth, revenue growth, margin expansion, a whole host of things. Now, a lot of this is detailed in my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. And I've outlined this whole quantitative and filtering and screening process pretty well in there. And we utilize that as a component of the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, which we manage money for clients. And one of the big things about that is that we always look for the number of stocks, because the number of stocks that make it through that screen is an important look through at, well, how are companies generally doing? So, for example, if we see, you know, 150 companies that are making it through that screen, and we're saying, hey, you know, things are pretty good, because usually the average is about 70. About 70 stocks or so, maybe 65, make it through that screen on a regular basis. Now, if we're starting to see a lot of stocks that can do well with their earnings growth and their momentum of their ROE and ROA, ROI, all these different things that come into play, and it's important for a company when we're looking for a growth company, hey, that's good. That's a good thing. when we're seeing things like, well, it goes from, let's just take an example, 150 stocks that, you know, 6 months later, we're seeing that only 40 stocks make it through that screen. What's happening? Why all of a sudden aren't all these companies making the grade? And why isn't it that companies can actually keep pace with a really nice growth of their ROE or of their earnings growth, whatever it is? Well, what's interesting that's happening right now is we've had 70, 72 for some time in there. It recently, last month, I saw it click down to about 65. Right now, we're in the 50s. Now, there could be a lot of reasons for that. It could be temporary, but that's something we want to watch. Why is it that companies are unable to meet the parameters of this screen from a growth standpoint? And why is it that out of all these stocks that we're looking at, is there a lot fewer names that are coming through? And I think that's very important. One of the things we do is we adjust our overall allocation to equities dependent on the number of stocks that actually can make it through that screen. So if you think about it, it's a natural expansion or contraction of our equity exposure. And that's an important thing to look at. If we're finding that stocks, even though the economy may be doing well or maybe not well, it really doesn't matter. But if the bottom line, if stocks aren't able to capitalize on whatever is happening out there in the economy, it's a really good read-through as how things are going underlying all of this. So I put that in the back of your mind just as something to think about as to what's happening with markets and to maybe look at your exposure to equities right now. One other thing I want to mention before we get to Lou. So, you know, I've mentioned before the TradeStation. And TradeStation, we write indicators for them. We have these great technical indicators that you can use if you're on the TradeStation platform. And you only could be on the TradeStation platform. You had to have an account. You had to have funding. You had to have trading authority. All these different things with regard to the platform. And you can get our Aileron, our Altimeter, Commander Series, all these great things. Well, that was a bit of a roadblock for people. You could have been on another platform. And all of a sudden, you want to check these out, but you can't because you got to get a whole new account. What a hassle. And unless you traded at TradeStation and made your main account over there, et cetera, you couldn't do it. Now, all of a sudden, I just found out about this. All of a sudden, you can actually just go and quickly sign up for a trial account. You don't even have to fund the account, pay for anything, nothing. And you can get 30 days of our indicators or the TradeStation platform free. Our indicators are a 10-day trial. But you get 30 days of the entire TradeStation free. What's cool about this is you don't have to fund it. You don't have to do anything. Just a quick form, your name, information about yourself. That's it. And you get the download of the entire platform of TradeStation for 30 days. This is not a commercial for TradeStation, but it's a commercial for our indicators. I'll put the links on the show notes for this episode. Check it out. And today I thought we'd bring on someone who I found very interesting in a recent article I read, as well as I think I saw him on TV somewhere, Lou Bassanese from Disruptive Tech Research. He's an independent researcher for all areas tech, plus the whole area of disruption, which we're going to talk about. And he provides research to hedge funds, independent investment advisors, and all sorts of other folks out there. So, Lou, hey, buddy, how are you?
I'm doing great. Great. Thanks for having me.
So I have a lot of questions. I mean, I think you and I talked about how a few weeks ago I had the gentleman on about the whole idea of autonomous cars. That's a big one. You know, it's a big disruptive technology. But there's a lot of things out there that are also under the radar. And of course, we like to put labels on everything, don't we? So we have to have the millennials and the Gen X. And now we have the disruptors and who knows what's next. It has to be a label, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So tell me what, and explain to me like I'm a child, which I kind of am. What's the whole idea of disruptive business?
Yeah, I mean, I think when everyone hears disruption, they think technology immediately, and I think it's much broader than that. It's the way I look at it is it's anything that reduces friction and does something easier, simpler, more elegant, that changes the dynamics of industries very quickly, disrupting current business practices with new ones. And I think really that the key component is the speed at which it's done, mm-hmm. how quickly things change. I mean, think about, Garmin, and they were the leading seller of, personal GPS units for use in your car. Their whole product became a feature of smartphones within a matter of a year or two, right? So that totally wiped out a, multi-million dollar business because the whole product itself got disrupted because it became a feature.
Right.
Yeah. So I think the speed is the key component of it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because a lot of things that are slow creep that could be, I guess, described as disruptive, which, you know, whatever that is. But I think more so when I think, well, tell me if I'm right, but when I think of the whole concept of disruption, it's going from what is the, I'll call it the status quo, what the accepted is, and into something that is, hey, you know what? While we accepted that and while that's fine, there's a better way. How come you guys who are involved in the status quo haven't done anything about it? You know what? We're going to take things in our own hands.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a buzzword. So every company and product and service out there tries to associate themselves with being disruptive, but not everything is. I think you hit it on the head. It's the, we're going to take this into our own hands because there is a better, smarter, safer, faster, cheaper way to do something.
I think the biggest example and the best example, maybe not the best, but at least it's right there, is Uber. No question about this. The whole idea of ride sharing, you know, if you really stop for a second and think about it, shame on the taxi companies. Am I right?
No, shame on the taxi companies. Absolutely.
I mean, all they had to do was come up with a freaking app and all would have been fine.
Yeah. But you know what? This is the other component I'd say. So there's speed, but then there's enabling technologies, right? It's a convergence. It's a timing issue. 10 years ago, Uber wouldn't have been possible.
Right.
Because we didn't have, you know, the capabilities of cloud services and big data to handle all the numbers crunching and, you know, all the coding expertise. I mean, it's just, you hate to say it that it's cliche, but it's right time, right place, right idea.
Right.
And you know, that's another component of it. Sometimes guys come up with ideas that are just ahead of their time and, you know, they flop because of it.
I mean, I had so many of those. I can't tell you just in concept, you know, sure. I was opening up VHS stores and video stores when they weren't anywhere. Now they would have, of course I would have been the next Blockbuster and sold out at the right time also, but nonetheless, I mean, no, seriously, there's so many ideas. Anybody has ideas out there. And look at, for example, you know, Shark Tank, as I hate to bring that up, or Kickstarter. I mean, there's a lot of ideas out there and people don't know how to go to the next level, but then there's technology, which, you know, really you talk about working out of your garage or off of one computer, because the power of one computer these days compared to what it used to be, and creating a basic thing and then expanding it through whether it's cloud or other kind of infrastructure. The fact is the cloud allowed us now to have crunching power instead of having a room full of servers, right?
Right. Yeah.
Really cheap.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a great idea and it requires a lot of extra bandwidth on the cloud side, on server space, you can rent it, you know, by the hour from Amazon. You don't have to worry about finding the real estate to put, you know, a server room in and outfit it with all the hardware, et cetera. I mean, these are all things that used to be impediments to businesses launching now that can be resolved in a couple clicks online. You can outsource everything.
And just to tell you how cheap this is, Amazon has 75,000 different components to their AWS services. I don't know if you've checked those out,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And some of you are like, well, what's the difference between that one and that one? I mean, they kind of look sort of the same. Anyway, there's one of them is a backup feature where you can put up data securely, backup computers and things of that nature on a secure basis. And there's some programs that go with it, and you can buy them separately or whatever. You link into it as secure, and you back up, let's say, your whole entire network like we do here for my office, right? We have many, many gigabytes of data up there, okay? Let's just call it, I don't know, for what that is, because everything else is on Salesforce and things like that, but let's call it 50 or 60 gigabytes of just junk, okay? 34 cents a month. I'm not kidding.
I believe it.
I'm like, how is that possible? So,
yeah, well,
and no bandwidth cost. Anyway, those are the kind of this disruptive issues where, you know, you used to have backup disks. And Western Digital, like, excuse me, guys, are you aware that it's outdated, as long as we have high-speed internet, to have a disk drive?
Right.
Right? You know, what's going to happen with – I also look at the camera market. You know, yeah, GoPro is a new little crappy little square thing with a lens that's high quality, good chips, good all that. But how long is a GoPro really going to be in favor, considering the fact that – phones have great cameras, and cameras, the old cameras, unless you're, you know, professional, who uses a camera anymore?
Yeah. Well, even the professional photographers, I have a cousin that's in, shoots sports photography for ESPN and HBO boxing and stuff. And they use digital cameras because the resolutions are far greater now.
Right. So, but the GoPro, for example, that was kind of in a way, I would call that, what would we call that? If it's not disruptive, but it kind of slices in the middle of other sides, you follow what I'm saying? So
right.
It wasn't like, wait a minute, now we don't need the cameras on our phones. What would you call that? Is there something there?
I just think we call it innovation, right? It's an incremental innovation. Yeah, we don't. It doesn't have to have a fancy name anymore.
I don't want to talk about it if it doesn't have a fancy name, for God's sakes. Let's talk about some of the things that are also disruptive. I do want to get, before we go, some things that are under the radar that we don't know about, okay? So first of all, you're talking about, like, you've talked a lot about the chip area.
Right.
And is the chip area a lot to do with the innovation of, we'll call it wearables or personal technology, or even, quote unquote, I hate this word, I just hate it, the Internet of Things? It sounds creepy. It's like Adam's family to me.
I would say it's more to do with the Internet of Things, but it's really just mobile. So, you know, everyone talks about the mobile revolution and the exploding use of mobile devices from tablets to smartphones. I mean, there's, you know, billions of smartphones in the world. And we always tend to focus on what we can see, right? You know, well, my smartphone now has a curved display, like on the new Samsung Galaxies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
or it has a fingerprint sensor like the iPhone rolled out, not long ago. But what we tend to forget about is the guts of the smartphones and any mobile device that makes them work. And that's really the chips. And what's the, you know, I know there's tons of apps for everything imaginable, from Uber to games and stuff, but what do we still use our smartphone for primarily? And that's communication, right? I mean, what's the worst thing that can happen? We can be in a place where we have no cell coverage.
Dare say that.
It's an unimaginable, right? Unless you're an outdoors person and you're just trying to get away, that's like everyone's fear. Hey, I'm going to end up where I have terrible cell coverage. Well, the chips that allow for that coverage to happen are a booming market. It's radio frequency communications. And not to get technical, the way to think about this from a simplistic way is that your phone needs to turn into a very specific channel, like your radio would turn into 95.5 on, you know, the FM dial. For your phone to receive information and send it back out, it's got to tune in to specific channels. Mm-hmm. And these chips allow that to happen. And the more people that try and get on networks, and the more data we send over the networks, the more channels, or, you know, here talked about a spectrum that needs to be opened up, but the harder it becomes to just tune in to those specific channels, because you've got to not only tune into the right channel, but you got to tune out all the wrong channels. So that's really the catalyst behind these huge mergers that we've seen in the mobile world. The most recent ones being Avago buying up Broadcom, and then Intel scooping up their largest acquisition to date in Altera. So,
and by the way, some of these acquisitions are seemingly enormously like, what's going on? Like, wow, that's a big number.
Yeah, I think Broadcom was $36 billion.
That's enormous for what that was.
Yeah. Gigantic.
I mean, I'm not saying it's not a bad company, whatever, but it just seemed a little bit hot.
Well, I mean, it's too, if you think about Avago, you know, their stock price and their market cap has, you know, doubled in the last year or so. So, they were able to do this transaction with cash. So they're, you know, they're taking advantage of the interest in the space and people bidding up their share price. So,
and the very low cost of financing right now. That's another thing that's a catalyst in this whole process. You talked about, let's talk about Skyworks Solutions. We happen to own that stock, and we've owned it for a while. Tell us about that stock and tell me a little bit about what it is you see as so special about it.
Yeah, I think Skyworks is they make the front end module. So they pull together different filters, RF filters, different power amplifiers, all the components that are necessary to allow these mobile devices to work. And, they're just a leader in terms of the technology. And then they're also a leader in providing integrated systems. So pulling things together as opposed to someone having to go out and buy all the individual parts separately from different providers. And that's really important nowadays, because when you consolidate those components into one part, you can shrink the size of it. And as you know, space inside of the mobile phones is a precious commodity, right? The real estate. So we want the makers, the handset makers, the Apples and Samsungs of the world, they want to have the most battery life they can. So they keep expanding the size of the battery and squeezing out room for the other components. So the thing I love about Skyworks, I mean, I've personally owned it as well, is they're just a leading systems integrator there. The handset makers, they've got business with all the major handset makers. Although they won't say it publicly, they always talk about our major tier one customer in North America that happens to be located in California.
The secrecy thing is, I don't get that.
Everyone knows who that, you know, one of their biggest customers is Apple, but you're not allowed to say it. But they do have all those big players in the mobile market as customers. But, you know, chips have typically been associated being with very cyclical business. But what we're seeing now is Skyworks is winning a lot of business in the automotive sector. You know, you talked about driverless cars, self-driving capabilities. So they're working their chips into those things, as well as the Internet of Things, the dreaded buzz phrase right now.
By the way, that the Internet of Things translates into your washer and dryer having a smart feature where you can communicate to it. And if you feel compelled at any given time to talk to it, maybe, and you know, get information like its load cycle, how many times it spins, the RPM on your smartphone. These are important features.
That's right. That's one of the ideas you had, right? That you were trying to commercialize.
Oh, yeah, I did. I was thinking, you know what? How great would it be if I could see a constant reading on my smartphone of how hot my dryer is as it's drying my towels?
Hey, your boxers are finished. It's time to go put a new pair on.
All right, let's talk about a few other things. So you talk about Skyworks Solutions. We talk about the Apple Watch, the Apple this, the all the Apple stuff. We know that obviously they're selling a ridiculous amount of stuff. But what about, there's a couple other things. Now, the area of that comes into play here, if everything is open and available and talking to each other, right, is that you have, just like in a conversation, people that overhear.
Right.
This would be the equivalent of hacking. Now, the hacking stocks, if you want to call them hacking stocks, have been on a tear. We talked about this last week with Frank Curzio, by the way. We talked about FireEye. We talked about, who else did we talk to? PANW. What's that stock?
Palo Alto.
Thank you. Palo Alto Networks. There's several other ones that are out there, Vasco Data Systems, and everyone does a little bit of a different thing here. But we're seeing that, for example, the Syrian army is hacking, or at least supposedly hacking the army. We get 4 million names hacked over here. Facebook, at least as far as we know, hasn't been hacked yet, which is either a testament to them or I'm not sure. It's a matter of time. Yeah, right. It's just we're waiting for the big one. How important is the concept of companies that can ensure that all criteria, because by the way, hacking isn't only into necessarily quote unquote software, hardware can be hacked too. I mean, from the routing it in, of course.
Right.
So when we get to the point of not, let's go way out in the future, cloud, for example, you know, you talk about disruptive technology, Box, iCloud, Dropbox, Google Drive, all these things where you don't need to have essentially very much space on your computer to store things, although they do replicate, a lot of these replicate on your computer anyway, but at least it's anywhere and accessible anywhere, we should say. The fact is that you no longer necessarily have to have big drives. That's why a lot of these laptops come with 128 gigs solid state drives these days. You don't need these big whopper 3 terabyte drives on your computer anymore. But yet we're still seeing that like a Seagate and Western Digital doing okay. But what level of importance do we put now on the whole idea of securing the data?
I think it's got to be top priority. I mean, this is the fundamental problem here is cybersecurity protecting data is at its core reactive, not proactive. Right. So it's mm-hmm. you're always trying to stay one step ahead of the criminals and you're always two steps behind.
It's kind of like the TSA.
Yeah. That's right. Right. it's true. But you're trying to, you know, you take the world's brightest individuals that use their skills for criminal intent and you're trying to catch up with them. And I think that's the difficulty here. I mean, it's a case of bad news for the victims, good news for cybersecurity companies. I mean, you see the latest attack on the Office of Personnel Management, 4 million records, right?
Yep.
Going back to 1985, they have personal data, social security, birth dates, everything you can imagine, bank information. You know, now you've got to respond to that. And there's new ways that they're finding to hack things. So, I mean, me personally, from an investment standpoint, you got to have a bottle of Pepto-Bismol next to your side if you're going to own these names individually. They are so volatile. But I do think, you know, the hack ETF gives you exposure to 31 of them. There's a new ETF that's coming out as well that I think is slated to come out. I know they filed the paperwork with the SEC in a couple months. So you're going to have ETFs that you can use to get exposure to this. But this is a trend that's it's not going away anytime soon.
Let me ask you a totally separate question, because you are a research analyst and you don't just cover just this. But since you mentioned ETFs,
right,
I'm kind of getting this weird vibe that it's enough with all these ETFs. Because I'll tell you why. You know, there's 31 different names you mentioned in that hack, and there's also all sorts of other ETFs. It makes it very easy for people to invest in things that they have no idea, by the way, of what it is. Right. And it seems also that it provides a significant amount of liquidity and volume to the underlying companies, whether they deserve it or not, right? So if somebody says, oh, we see that the FireEye just got this new deal and all that, you know what, I don't know if I want to pick that stock or not, I'm going to buy the ETF. Do you think that there's some eventual negative implication of all these ETFs that are pumping money into all these names that maybe shouldn't have as much volume, liquidity, or at least attention?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a risk, systematic risk, somewhere down the line. What's going to disrupt the ETF like the ETF disrupted the mutual fund, right? I mean, ETFs, they're not creating new assets out of thin air. They're just gathering assets that used to go into mutual funds, and it's primarily a cost basis and a passive investing approach. So, yeah, I mean, I do think that they provide a lot of extra liquidity to some of these individual names. But in the case of in the cybersecurity, you know, the difficulty for me, I've tried to find small and mid-cap ways to play cybersecurity. The difficulty is finding someone or handicapping who has the superior solution. And I don't think any individual company does, because the nature of cyber attacks change, the technology evolves. I think it's foolish to assume that you can find the one company or the two individual companies that have the silver bullet solution, because it right. doesn't exist.
But a lot of investors are playing certain names just for the hell of it. But that's right. just like, by the way, this is a good segue into biotechnology. It's exactly the same research concept of, okay, well, we got all these companies that are looking for a cure for cancer or hep C or name your poison, you know, whatever particularly it is. And how do you, you know, particularly handicap one or the other? Well, these days, all you have to do is buy something under $5 that sees a little bit of a volume pump and then just wait 5 minutes.
Yeah, pretty much. My philosophy on biotech is I don't have an MD after my name, so I'm not investing in them. It's so specialized. You can ride the trend. There's a lot of investors that look to trend, you know, ride particular trends. You can certainly do that with ETFs. That makes it possible. But, you know, you're not just getting into I like to research technologies that I can pick up and experience with my own hands and demo and validate that it works. There's no way to do that with biotech. You know, you can't jump inside. What was that movie back in the 80s where, you know, you went inside? Short or whatever, the little guy shrunk in, you know, got miniaturized. You know, you can't go into the body to see how these new drugs interact. And there's no way that you can handicap and say that you know for certain that a drug is going to be effective.
Fantastic Voyage? Was it Fantastic Voyage?
No, I can't remember. I don't think it was Fantastic Voyage. It'll come to me. Mm.
I agree with you, by the way. I totally agree with you. Now, let's get down to a few things here. This is going to be... You know, I don't want to hear the Bloomberg or CNBC line here, party line, okay? Sure. I want you to tell me what is happening that, you know, is really kind of shaking the bottom of things in any particular sector, by the way, that can be kind of something that may be, you know, coming up as a next kind of, hey, look at this, whether it's technology or if it's a particular service or something.
Yeah, no, I've got two, and one's going to be in an industry that everyone knows, and it's mobile, and the other one's going to be in energy, which we don't typically think of as, you know, very innovative. But so the first one is wireless charging.
This is great, because I had a bet that we had DH Unplugged we talk about on another podcast on Tuesday nights, and I gave a list of things that will not be here in 20 years. And I went down the list. One of them was Yahoo, by the way. But we went down the list of different things that, you know, where I said to my kids or somebody, I said, hey, do you remember? And they'll be like, huh? You know? So one of the things on that list was the charging cable.
Gone inside.
So, okay,
five
here
years.
We go. Okay, great.
Yeah.
So wireless charging, how does that work? Is it close proximity?
Is it across
the room?
Yeah, you know. So everything that's on the market now, everyone kind of poo-poos the idea of wireless charging because they see these mats. You know, if you go into some Starbucks, they have these power mats where you plug this little dongle into your phone and stick it on a mat, and all you've done is swap your charging cord for a surface. You still have to be tethered to something, right? And it's completely unusable. I can't stick my head down on the countertop at Starbucks and make a phone call. So this is true wireless charging at a distance, so up to 30 feet. So imagine just walking into the Starbucks and your phone automatically starts charging. Imagine getting into your car and you turn it on and your iPad starts charging as well. So I've done, you know, for the last 3 years, a lot of research into the players here. There's two that are private and one that's public that are kind of leading the edge in the innovation. So the two that are private, one is called Osaya and the other one is called Ubeam. You've probably seen a lot of press about it. Meredith Perry, young entrepreneur from UPenn, got backing from some of these big Silicon Valley names, including Mark Cuban, Peter Thiel. And then the other one is a publicly traded company called Energys. The ticker on it is Watt, W-A-T-T. How clever. Yeah, it is. Well, it's funny. Their technology is called What Up, as in Watt Up. And I can't, every time I hear the CEO say it, I can't help but remember those terrible Budweiser commercials from, you know, a decade ago. Yeah.
Now, let me understand something. So let's take this to its furthest potential, okay? So we know now that we have this ridiculous wireless pad thing or plug it in or whatever, we have batteries. Next, what we're saying in this is something like, okay, wireless charging, however that looks. You know, you kind of enter into a space and your phone picks up on the fact that, hey, there's electrodes in the air or whatever the deal is, and it charges your battery. This also comes to the this also begs to question whether or not the current battery is going to be the electrical source for devices in the future. But let's just stay with the fact that it is, okay?
Right.
So now we walk into somewhere and I don't know, you have to pay 25 cents. I don't know what the deal is exactly. It's free, whatever it is. You get this wireless charge. Why not take it one step further that it's ubiquitous? You know, right now, in the old days, it's like, you got Wi-Fi here, you got Wi-Fi there. One day you'll have Wi-Fi. Everybody's like, my wife says, my son Brett, he's coming down from Orlando and the bus has Wi-Fi. I'm like, who gives a crap? But what is that important about? Well, what do you mean? You can check out you can be on his computer, he can be on his phone and on Wi-Fi on the way down. I'm like, what about like LTE and 3G? Who cares? Right. Wi-Fi is everywhere right now. Not the Wi-Fi little signal, but through LTE and 3G. That's Wi-Fi, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, you're getting to access the internet. That's really what you want.
So why not make something where just charging is everywhere, or maybe it will be?
Well, that's the vision here. So it's, you know, the Energys is the furthest along commercially. They have a tier one customer that is engaged with them. It's either Apple or Samsung. And what they want to do is make it ubiquitous. So the technology itself works over the Wi-Fi signal. You can actually send energy over RF signals and harvest it at the phone. So basically send it out over the Wi-Fi signals and then aggregate it on the phone. In terms of, hey, how are we going to get this in phones? It could actually, the technology, the chip can be coupled with the regular Bluetooth chip. So you don't have to add anything special. It could be built right into the phones. And the vision is that you're going to have, just like you have, you know, if you have Wi-Fi everywhere, it means there's a wireless router wherever you're at. You're getting the Wi-Fi signal from a router. So what the vision is to have ubiquity is to have the wireless router paired with the wireless charging. So anywhere you go in, there's a Wi-Fi signal. You also can get charging.
You know, I don't know why. I'm just, maybe this is old fashioned of me, but I'm thinking the wireless charging, all I keep thinking is like brain cancer.
Yeah, no. That's the biggest obstacle to it, right?
Oh, it is.
Do you remember though? You remember though when microwaves came out? Like everyone was afraid to stand in front of microwaves because it, you know. But
my grandmother called it the radar range.
Right.
The radar. She was the first with this gigantic radar range thing, and you couldn't stand anywhere near it. I'm not so sure it's so safe anymore. It's so safe either, but that's another story.
Yeah. So this is the Energys and Osaya both use Wi-Fi signals. Ubeam uses ultrasound to send wireless power. So the Wi-Fi signal using it, they're using the same spectrum ranges as a cordless phone. So it's not going to be any different than using your mobile phone in terms of.
I see a lot of people with hearing aids blowing up. I'm just saying. I see it happening. I see
you
it happening.
You live in Florida, though, right? So the demographic, yeah. It's a little bit older.
Yeah. All right. So why I'm with you on this, by the way. I think this. I, you know what? I hate to say this. It's really cool. I'm not so shot up about it. I'm not saying it's not cool.
No, it's super cool, but there's some obstacles.
No, but I've heard about it before, concept wise and all that. What? Give me something else. Give me energy.
Yeah, energy space. Imagine,
well, this is kind of energy, but go ahead.
This is, you know, president wants to change the environmental regulations to cut down on smog, right? I mean, get really, really strict. The number that everyone looks at is the ozone number. They're talking about the EPA dropping that level to 65 or 70 from, I think currently it's at 75.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, we've tried every way we can to cut emissions down, and there's not much low hanging fruit left. So there's a company called ClearSign Combustion. The ticker is CLIR. Full disclosure, I own it. Anything I research, I own as well. Hopefully not everything.
Hopefully the things only that you
like. No. Everything I research and go out to provide research right. on, coverage right. on. I'm sorry. Right. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying. Yeah. I just own it all.
I buy the crap. I buy everything. It doesn't matter. Go ahead.
And I'm thankful for the editing on there. So one of the biggest pollutants, there's three components to smog. One is sunlight. We can't do anything about sunlight. It's going to be there. The other one is what are called VOCs, volatile organic compounds. Can't do anything about those really either, because natural things like trees put out VOCs. The third thing is nitrous oxide. So that's the one pollutant that we can control. And if you look at all the regulations in heavy industry, that's what they're trying to cut emissions down on, nitrous oxides and carbon dioxide. And ClearSign has developed a very elegant, simple burner technology where when you're combusting fuel, that it knocks down the NOx emissions, no pun intended, by upwards of 80 to 90%. So just to give you in context, like oil refiners, right? They use these burners in various parts of the refinery process where they're heating up the liquids and they're doing the refining, but it requires a lot of high temperature process. So the burners that they use, some of them, the regulations call for them to be below 15 parts per million of NOx. ClearSign can get them below 5 parts per million. So you're talking about a huge reduction. And then the impact on this obviously is environmental. You can cut down the amount of smog that's being formed because you're cutting down one of the main ingredients of smog. So this is a company that I started following. It was really, I kid you not, was really a Bunsen burner in a lab 3 years ago. And now they're commercializing. So they just booked their first order, and their first commercial customer is Aera Energy, which nobody probably knows by name, but you know who owns Aera Energy. It's actually a joint venture between Exxon and Shell. Mm. So it's the biggest natural gas producer in California, over $5 billion in annual revenues. And they've installed ClearSign's technology on what's called a once-through steam generator that helps them pump oil out of the ground by using steam. So again, it's a boring, totally unexciting sector industry type of technology. I mean, you talk about energy and no one really thinks about that. But then think again about fracturing, right? Hydraulic fracturing. That's changed the entire landscape of energy independence for the U.S. So this has similar, I don't want to say this is the next hydraulic fracturing, but from a pollution control standpoint, and then here's the other kicker that really for me was the put a clear sign over the top. They're the only emissions control technology that has an economic benefit. So it's not, you know, most things, Aera Energies of the world, most times they have to do things to control pollution because the regulators tell them they have to, and it just costs them money. This actually saves them money because it's more efficient heat transfer and requires less fuel. And it allows them to get rid of some other costly filtering technologies, basically, that they have to use. So it's an economic benefit, which I think is a big thing for when we talk about disruption. You got to think about why in the world is the company, the end customer, going to use it? And if it doesn't make things easier, cheaper for them, it's not going
to
happen.
Oh, you're saying they're not just going to do it to help out the world and all?
No, altruism, you know, yeah. that whole, it's the whole Milton Friedman, you know, the purpose of a business is to generate a profit, maximize shareholder value, not save the world.
Let me ask you a question. I don't know if you know this, and we'll kind of end it on this, but the restaurant space, you familiar with it at all? Do you do any research in that area?
I do follow it, absolutely.
You know, I'm kind of getting overwhelmed with all this restaurant stuff, right? You know, like burger this and burger that and, you know,
Shake Shack.
Shake Shack, I can't short it. I can't get a borrow. There's no options available for the darn thing. Okay. We did short it a little bit for a little while. We got a little kicked out of it and kind of, I think we made a little bit of money one time, but nonetheless, no major commitments into it. And then all of a sudden it went dark green. I can't get any borrows. And again, there's no options. But it's more than that. I mean, first of all, unless people are totally brainwashed, because I think, you know, people believe commercials these days, where the old days would be like, okay. You know, you see a sign, best hamburger in the world. It's like, oh, like what? Anybody can put that up. There's no council that decides on that, you know? But you have that, and you have these chicken companies, and you have these, you know, various things. And one of the things, I mean, first of all, I personally, the whole mass production of food is very disturbing to me. You know, whereas, you know, you go to Europe, you go to somewhere else around the world, it's kind of a one plate for one person concept. You know, whereas here it's like, okay, every hamburger is exactly 8.2757 ounces, and you put one thinly sliced tomato this weight. You know, this whole thing is like, okay, we are robotically eating. But right. but I understand the point of it. The point of it is to maintain profitability, profit margins, and to understand what it takes to run a business, and whether or not these big companies like a Cheesecake blew out all the mom and pop shops, or the mom and pop shops blew themselves out because they didn't understand how to order and how to inventory and how to, you know, portion control and all that. What's going on here? I mean, is it just this generation that just is, you know, it's kind of, I'm trying to think about it. Oh, I know what it is. Down in South Beach, Florida. You go down there and you go to a restaurant back in the day, especially go down there and you go to a restaurant and like, oh, it's great. 6 months later, it's like, where to go?
Right.
Like, this place was packed every single night. Oh, they move next door, all the people. Like, it's like a pack of roving, you know, what's hot now concept, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's happening right now with restaurants. Like, what's the big thing? It's the gluten-free today. It's the, you know, it's the craft beers, the IPAs and all that good stuff, which not my thing. Or whether it's going to be, okay, you know, the classic burger and, you know, we'll go through that. What's going on in this industry?
Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that it's there's fickleness, right? I mean, they go 6 months and this restaurant's hot, and then 6 months later, everyone's moved over. I mean, it's akin to me like the fashion industry. Really, really competitive. How do you stay on top of consumer preferences and tastes? And yeah, I think you're seeing a move away from the major food providers, from the traditional fast food restaurants to, you know, look at the success of Chipotle. What's really catapulted that? Well, there's an awareness. There's people want healthier, organic. You know, now you got the gluten-free. It's, you know, I look at, too, look at the disruption that Whole Foods created in the grocery market, and now look what's happening. They're struggling because everyone else from Safeway to Walmart is getting into organic. So, again, the restaurant space, I think, is very difficult from an investment standpoint to go long. A lot of hype in it now with Shake Shack and that IPO. I think you're smart to try and play the end of the trends, looking to short it. You know, maybe low cost options, puts and stuff. But yeah, I just see it as a very dangerous sector of the market right now.
Yeah, I don't get it. Maybe, I don't know. I just, some of it is very disturbing to me. I think what we need to do is just everybody just let's go back to the old fashioned New York style diner that has everything from liver to eggs on the menu 24 hours a day. And you know what's great about that place? The place can change on a dime. Not to mention right. You get a good egg cream there probably.
Yeah.
But no.
I try to explain the diner concept to my children. They don't get what it is.
Oh,
so.
I weep for them. I do. I do. You know, the only French fry that is better than a diner's French fry is a bowling alley French fry.
I think you're probably right there. Yeah.
Have you ever, seriously? I mean, what is it with bowling alleys? You could have a bowling alley that will serve rancid food, but their French fries are like, that's great. That's just fabulous.
So they've never changed the oil in 25
years. That's probably all. What it is. There's nothing wrong with that. This new generation wants to change every hour on the arrow, the canola oil or the sunflower oil. So anyway, Lou Balinese, we're going to have all of the information on how to get in touch with you on the disciplineinvestor.com show notes. And we will put where to find you and all about you. And I appreciate you being here. Any parting notes on anything that you'd like to bring up that we haven't brought up?
No, I think we covered a lot. I mean, I'd say from the standpoint of being a tech investor, to do your own due diligence first. Don't buy into the hype because it's an easy way to lose money.
Yep, so. I hear you. All right, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye. All right, again, we'll have all of the information on how to get in touch with Lou and find out more about his services and things that you can read about and all that on the show notes of this episode over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And just to mention once more, I really want you to check out the TradeStation platform. Just do me a favor. Just check it out. Check out the Commander Series indicators that we have available. There's an update coming in about, well, I would say about 30 days because we have a major, really, really cool update coming. Take a little while to code it, but nonetheless, it's coming. In the meantime, you still have the great core algorithms with the Commander Series, which gives you a multi-time frame look at the altimeter, the autopilot, and the radar. Really, really neat stuff, and it's free, so what the heck. I thought we'd spend a little time talking about the bubble. I've mentioned this before about China, but I want to mention one thing that I think it's really interesting to look at right now. Valuations aside, new accounts aside, levels of the exchange aside, all the bullishness aside, one thing that struck me as, wow, this is unbelievable, is that there has been an incredible run and even a rush to take companies private off of the U.S. markets. Many of the Chinese companies that are trading in the U.S. are going private so that they can extract themselves off of the U.S. markets and go public again in an IPO on the China markets, on the China exchanges. Now, think about that. Well, why is it? What's happening? One of the things is that there's less compliance, less oversight. They can do a lot more with their numbers there. The other thing is there's been a feeding frenzy. IPOs have been limit up for days. 10% a day is the limit up over there on a stock. And you've been seeing that several IPOs that come out of companies, even if they're not new companies, they're existing companies, but they re-IPO in the on the Shanghai or the Shenzhen index, have been really on fire, just going crazy. There's been an absolute, I can't think of anything else but a frenzy. The word frenzy describes it, to actually get shares of any of those companies. And what these companies are doing is they're just getting money from their owners or from other folks, and they're just buying out the whole entire position, going private at some kind of premium here, realizing that if they go on the index in China, they're really going to have just an incredible amount of liquidity flow into them for no other reason that they're now available. This is something that should be really putting a light bulb off in your head, an alert, an alarm, a concern that something's just not right, that they're willing to actually come off the exchanges here just to blossom their stocks over there on ridiculous valuations. And when you combine that with all the other things that we've talked about in terms of their economy shrinking, the recent numbers over the weekend were very poor, the fact that mainly the government spending is doing nothing more than really popping up valuations of stocks, which is good for markets. I think we hit some incredible milestone on the Shanghai index over this week and the 100% gain that we've seen over the last several months there. The new accounts opened, and now this is probably the top of the point where you have to say that things are getting a little out of hand. It can go on for a while longer, but each and every day, what you're finding is a lot of these stocks, like like the ones that have been trading here, small names, have been running up dramatically because the hope is that they will go private, and many of them have, and then just be taken off the U.S. exchanges and traded in China, and where you have no more access to them, by the way. So you might as well get the money while it's hot. Just something to think about, something to consider. Check out all the things that are available to you on thedisciplinedinvestor.com in terms of the access to the information on the Aero strategy, $50,000 minimum, algorithm strategy that we put together for the S&P 500 in short, out, dependent on trend and overbought, oversold indicators that we developed. It's been long for a while now. It's been long since January, which is really interesting, showing that there has been a nice move to the trend on the upside recently, although it's starting to turn to a different direction very recently. We'll see how that plays out. Also, the TDI managed growth strategy and our global allocations and everything else that you want to find about what we're doing and all that for our clients over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll see you again next week. Thanks for joining me.
Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.